Greetings and welcome back to OU.org and www.etshalom.com in our ongoing study of the book of Samuel, Sefer Shmuel, Aleph. My name is Yitzchak Etshalom, and today we will be tackling the 19th chapter, Shmuel Aleph Perek Yod Tet. Let's commence immediately as we follow the rather sad interaction between Shaul and David, which is the result, of course, of Shaul's jealousy brought on by the melancholia or the ruach ra'ah, which has infected Shaul. Beginning of Perek Yod Tet, Shaul seems to be unaware of how close Yonatan is with David, his own son. Yonatan and his strong feelings for David, which we read about at the beginning of the previous chapter. So after Shaul was unsuccessful in finding ways for David to die, having him marry his daughter and therefore go out to battle to win her payment for marrying her. And after having turning him into the his chief of staff so that he would be always out at war, nonetheless, everywhere David turns, he is successful, and so Shaul is unsuccessful in getting David killed. Alright, so he spoke with Yonatan and with all of his servants to figure out a way to kill David. Yonatan ben Shaul chafetz David meod. The text then reminds us of something that we saw in the previous chapter, that Yonatan, son of Shaul, loved David very much, felt very positively towards David. Now, notice the wording of Yonatan ben Shaul chafetz b'David meod. That highlights the tension that exists in this chapter and the following chapter, and the fact that it is Yonatan who is the heir apparent. Evidently, the only son of Shaul gets any positive mention in all of these chapters, and he gets lots of positive mention. We have every reason to believe that he would be the crown prince, and therefore his mention as Yonatan ben Shaul is particularly poignant, is very supportive of David. Now, we, the reader, already know that David has been anointed as the next king, which means that Yonatan seems to be forfeiting his future here and the future of the family. We'll see that more explicated a little further on. So Yonatan spoke to David and told him what was happening. Shaul wants to kill you. Notice he pointed out not just Shaul the king, but Shaul my father. Again, making it more painful, more intimate. Wants to kill you. And now you should be careful in the morning and hide, and there's a plan coming up. Go into hiding and hide there. Vani etzeva matili aravi basadeh. So I will go out with my father, because the idea is you go into hiding and I'm going to go out with my father to an area near where you are, but he won't know you're there. Basadeh shorat hasham. Vani adaber b'chai el aviv ra'itima v'igadatilach. And I'll speak to my father and we'll see what's doing and I'll tell you. Now, there's two ways to understand this. One is, you're going to go hide, I'll talk to my father, you will not hear us, but as soon as your father tells me what's really going on, I'll be able to tell you. But then, if that's the case, then why would Yonatan go to the field where David is hiding? So evidently, v'gadatilach means that then I will inform you, meaning I'm going to go out with father to the field where you are, you'll be hiding, and you will overhear father say what he really wants to do with you. Evidently, at this point, David does not believe Yonatan. David somehow refuses to believe, in spite of the fact that Shaul tried to attack him twice, and that Shaul seems to be looking at him with a negative eye. David refused to believe it, so Yonatan now has to convince him that the threat is real. Bring Yonatan and David tov el Shaul. So here's what happened. Yonatan spoke well about David to Shaul. Aviv, vayomer elav, al yechata melech b'avdo v'David. Don't hurt David. In other words, Yonatan now is formulating his response to Shaul's early request of finding ways to hurt David. He said, don't sin against David. your servant, ki lo chatalach, first of all, he's done nothing to you. And notice the phrasing, al yechta melech David, don't sin against him, ki lo chatalach, he has not sinned against you. Also, everything he does is good for you. In other words, not only do you have no personal claim against him, but his existence and his success is actually helping you. He put his life into his hands, literally. In other words, he risked his life. He killed the Plishti. This seems to be referring to the war with the Plishti giant. And God made a great victory for Israel, great salvation. You saw it, you were happy. And why would you sin against by shedding innocent blood, killing David for no reason? Notice again the word chata here. Shaul is being accused of a potential sin, that even as king, he doesn't have the right to take innocent blood, and David is innocent. But notice the way that Yonatan structures his words. He begins by saying, don't sin against David. He hasn't done anything against you. And what he does is very good for you. And then he points to the particular thing that David has done to promote Shaul, the salvation and the great victory after 40 days of fear and trepidation and military paralysis against the Plishti giant, pointing out that God is with him. Then he goes back and he says he saved, again, going back to the idea of the victory over the Plishti, and he has not sinned against you, and it would be spilling innocent blood. So what we have here is a chiasmus, A, B, C, B, A. A being the shedding of innocent blood. David has not done nothing against you. B, he has been successful and has promoted you. And C, right in the middle, is God is with him. And that is a phrase that we already saw used in the context of Yonatan himself before David came on the scene, where the people saved Yonatan from Shaul's hand at the end of chapter 14 when they said, Yonatan should not die on this day because God has done a great victory with him on this day. Yonatan. Right? God has done a great victory with him, and therefore Yonatan shouldn't be touched. Yonatan is not using that, now using the same argument that saved him from Shaul to save his friend David from Shaul. And we see it successful provisionally. And Shaul listened to Yonatan's voice. That means that he accepted his argument. And Shaul made an oath that by Hashem's life, he will not die. Now, we've already seen that Shaul's oaths do not mean much. What bothers us perhaps more here is that he's using God's name to take this oath, and soon he will change his mind and again try to kill David. But for right now, he seems to mean it, and that's part of the evil spirit that infects him, is that he switches moods. And for right now, David seems to be safe. Vayikra Yonatan l'David, vayagid lo Yonatan kol hadvarim ha'ela. And so Yonatan called David and told him everything that happened, and he brought Yonatan to Shaul. Yonatan brought David to Shaul, and they had the relationship they used to have in the past, Ketmol Shoshom. Now, what's critical here is that the text, every time that Shaul tries to hurt David, we see the text says, from that day on, Shaul hated David. And at this point, the text seems to challenge that by saying, well, it's not true that from that day on Shaul hated David. But what the text is doing is giving a sense of perspective. From when Shaul is angry at David, it is an anger that's going to burn forever. When Shaul is in a different kind of mood or has been spoken to differently, and we'll see several other examples between here and the end of Shmuel Aleph, suddenly everything is fine. But the heat of anger and jealousy and hatred that exists when Shaul is against David is so powerful that it is felt at the moment to be an eternal one that could not possibly change. And that's what we've seen several times already. And now we go back to the battlefront. There was more war against the Plishtim. David went out and fought against the Plishtim, and he slew them, a great smiting, and they ran away from him. Again, you see the Plishtim are a constant thorn in Shaul's side, and David goes out to particular battles with them, and every time he's successful. And so what happened? God's evil spirit again came to Shaul, This is the scene we saw in the last chapter. Same exact scene. Shaul was sitting in the house. He's holding onto his spear in his hand. And David, in the meantime, was playing with his hand, playing the instrument with his hand. Meaning, again, that David has an instrument of serenity and of music in his hand, and Shaul has a weapon of war in his hand. And that means not only is the apposition presented very clearly as to where each one of them is, but again, the irony that David is playing the instrument in order to soothe Shaul doesn't help. God's bad spirit comes. That idea of the music playing soothing is just not going to do it. Second thing is that, of course, the odds are very strong in favor of Shaul. He's got a weapon, and David, his hands are occupied with something else, not as if he can defend himself. What happens? Again, he wanted to skewer David against the wall with his spear. And somehow he ran away from Shaul. And so the spear went into the wall, missing David. David nasfei malei palailahu, and this is at night, and David ran away and escaped. Unlike the previous time where David simply dodged the spear twice and evidently stayed put, perhaps he didn't believe what happened or he rationalized it some other way, this time he understands Shaul is after him in spite of the oath, in spite of their recent rapprochement. At this point, David understands that Shaul is after him, and he runs away. Notice something strange about the text. Vayimaleit balayla hu is a strange phrase. He ran away at night, him. The meaning of the text is Vayimaleit balayla hahu. On that night he ran away. And as Rav Reuven Magalia points out in one of his brief essays in a collection of Masorot Vamikra, that occasionally the text, when it has the end of a word ends in a particular letter, and the next word begins with the same letter, will sometimes drop one of them, and certainly where there would be an occasion of three letters in a row. And he explains that here the meaning is balayla hahu, the second hey drops out. And another example is when the night when Yaakov sleeps with Leah after the event with the mandrakes, it says balayla hu again, and therefore then the meaning is balayla hahu. He points out there are about 10, 15 different examples in Tanakh where that happens. In any case, Vayishlach Shaul Malachim El Beit David Shomro, Falamitova Boker. Interested reader, take a look at Psalm 59. Shaul sent messengers to David's house to guard him and to kill him in the morning. It was keep an eye on him, and then assuming he would leave in the morning on his way out of the house to kill him. David Michal Ishtolimor. Watch this. Everybody is working against Shaul. His own son Yonatan is working against Shaul in his plot against David. His own daughter Michal, David's wife, is working against him. And she says, if you don't sneak out tonight, then tomorrow you're dead. Somehow Michal found out. Maybe Shaul confided in her. Maybe she found out some other way. Maybe she saw the guards outside. But she told David, if you don't sneak out tonight, you're a dead man tomorrow. What happened? Vatored Michal at David ba'ar ha'chalon. So Michal let David out through the window. He ran out and he escaped. This reminds us, of course, of another heroine, which is Rahav, the second chapter of Yoshua, letting the spies out the window and having them escape when the king is after them. Vatikach Michal tatrafim. And so Michal took some trafim. Trafim are household idols. We'll talk about them in a moment. And she put them in the bed to make it look like there was a body there. And she took some goat's hair, she put at where the point where his head would be, and then she covered it up with a garment. So in other words, she lined up a few idols that would be in the shape of a human, all lined together, covered it with a blanket, and then put some goat's hair at the top. It would look like that was his hair, so that when the guards came in, it would look like David's there, and he's in bed, and he can't get out of bed, and David would have more time to get away before they figured out that he was not there. Several points about this. First of all, what is Michal doing with Trafim?
Trafim, we have seen in another context in Tanakh, were household idols and may have an association with fertility. And we know in the case of Rachel, for the famous story of Rachel stealing the Trafim, that some of the traditional explanations as to why she stole her father's household idols, the Trafim, are a little bit difficult. If we take the explanation that Rashi provides, that she stole the Trafim because she wanted to keep her father from doing idolatry, then why not destroy them? Why hold on to them the whole time? If it was, as the Radak explains, that the Trafim were something of a homing device that would allow, a tracking device that would allow Lavan to find Yaakov, and she wanted to keep that from happening, well, that obviously didn't work, because Lavan did find Yaakov. There is an explanation that Radak suggests in his father's name that Rachel really wanted the Trafim for herself because she was having problems with fertility. There are, by the way, other historical explanations as to why she took the Trafim, but that's not our issue here. As we will find out in Shmuel Bet Perek Vav, Michal has fertility issues also, and that may be the reason that she has these Trafim. There may be other reasons also, but she clearly has Trafim in her house, which is a little bit troubling. Second thing to point out is that she takes goat's hair to have it imitate David's hair. Goat's hair, by and large, is either black or white. Chances that the young David has white hair at this point is not anything that we have any reason to believe. And so we have every indication that David's hair is black. Of course, the text at no point said that David is red-haired, and so people who always talk about David as Jinji Yahu, that red-haired boy, really are basing it on, I think, a misunderstanding of the text, that when David is first introduced to us in chapter 16, we're told he's Admoni, but that doesn't mean red hair, it means ruddy of skin. And in chapter 17, that's why the Philistine giant made fun of him, because he had red skin, the idea being that he didn't wear lots of armor and clothing, and he was exposed to the sun as a shepherd, and that was part of what he was making fun. There's nothing to make fun of him if he has red hair. That's nothing that he's done. In any case, that's how she masked David's disappearance, something that brings up some interesting images as far as other characters in more recent history who have fooled people to believe, make them believe that they were in bed, sick, but were not. But in the meantime, we'll continue on. Vayishlach Shaul malachim lakachat et David vatomer cholehu. So Shaul then sent the messengers in the morning to find David. Now, evidently, he didn't send the messengers to say, we got to come in and kill him, but they said, where is David? And she said, he's sick. Vayishlach Shaul et malachim lirot et David lemor halu oto b'mitai lai lamito. So the messengers came back to Shaul and said, she said he's sick. So he said, go get him. Go get him, bring him in his bed here. And the impression could be, Shaul is still a little wily. The impression could be, Shaul needs him for some urgent issue, and he needs to see him right away, so bring him even if he's sick. And of course, the real reason is bring him that way to kill him. But what's happening now is that Shaul's circle of confidence is widening, because now these agents know that Shaul wants to kill him. Vayavo hamalachim, unless the last word lahamito there is not something he told the messengers. He told the messengers, bring David even in his bed, and Shaul's intent was to kill him, and he's still keeping it close to the vest. Vayavo hamalachim v'nei trafim el hamita uchvir ha'izim rashotav. So the agents came, and they came to drag David out of bed, and they opened up the sheets, and they found that that there were these idols there, and the goat's hair, and they'd been fooled. So now Shaul turns to Michal and says, "Lama kacha rimitini? Why have you fooled me this way?" And now everything's coming out. He says, "You sent my enemy away." That's, by the way, your husband. You sent him away. He escaped. I wanted to kill him. So Michal is not willing to stand up to Shaul and be honest and say you're wrong, because you can't. He's the king. So what does she say to him? Hu amar elai shalchini lama amitech. He said to me, send me away or I'll kill you. And he threatened me. Now, Shaul at this point should say, fine, but as soon as he was gone, you should have told me. He couldn't have killed you then. Shaul accepts this argument provisionally. Now, before we follow David towards the end of the chapter and see how he escapes and where he escapes to, just a couple points about this. First of all, this is another reminder of Rahab, who, if you look at the beginning of chapter 2 in Yehoshua, see that she very successfully lies to the king about the whereabouts of the Israelite spies who came into her inn or tavern, probably her inn, to stay. And in the same way, Michal lies to the king about the whereabouts and about the circumstances of why she was dishonest. Second thing is that we have a triangular relationship that's presented in this text of Michal, Shaul, and David, with Michal caught in the middle between loyalty to her father and loyalty to her husband. And that reminds us of another threesome where we have a challenge of loyalty between husband and father, and that is, of course, Rachel, Lavan, and Yaakov. And Rachel and Michal, in both cases, choose loyalty to the husband over loyalty to the father, and in both cases, lie to the father, not standing up, and not that we would expect them to, or would necessarily be happy about it, but standing up to the father and saying, you're wrong, but rather finding a way around their behavior to explain it so that they are not being defiant to their father, but nonetheless siding with their husband. In both cases, it involves trafim, which are being hidden and are part of the subterfuge. That, of course, paints Shaul in a very sour light because it paints Shaul as a parallel to Lavan, and that is probably very intentional on the part of the text. There is yet another piece to the puzzle, is that another argument for why Rachel took the trafim is that we find in the ancient world that the ownership or possession of the household gods was a sign of special stake in the household. It may have been held by the Bechor, by the eldest son. And it could be that Rachel was claiming these really on behalf of Yaakov, even though Yaakov didn't know about it, in order for him to have a greater stake in Lavan's household. Look very carefully at Rachel's words, Rachel and Leah's words to Yaakov when he tells them they're about to leave. She says, do we have any more portion in our father's house? And they may be indeed referring, this is chapter 31 in Bereishit, they may be indeed referring to the fact that they've been cut out of father's household, and Rachel taking the trafim immediately at that point may be an attempt to hold on to a stake in father's house. If that's the case, then we understand the parallel even stronger, because Michal, using the trafim here, is an attempt to keep David alive and to keep David's stake in Shaul's house, which right now publicly is very strong, to keep that alive. There's much more to speak of there, but it's beyond the context of this form. And so now we have David, we follow David. David barach vayimaleit vayavor al Shmuel haramata. For the second and only other time, David encounters Shmuel. He runs up to Ramah to Shmuel. Vayigalod kol asher asah lo Shaul, tells Shmuel everything that Shaul has done. Vayelechu Shmuel vayishvu b'nayot. So they went out to the pastures. This is already evidently the next morning. The pastures that are in Ramot. Why? We'll see in a moment. Vayugad l'Shaul l'morin in David b'nayot baramah. And now the war is going to be very frontal of Shaul versus David and Shmuel, we think. And so Shaul finds out that David is in Nayot up in Ramah. And Nayot is the pastures outside of Ramah. Vayishlach Shaul malachim lakachat David. So Shaul sent messengers to take David. And vayard lahakat hanavim nibim. Ushmuel omei nitzav alehem. And we find out what was happening out the pastures. There were prophets that were prophesizing, as I talked about in chapter 10, the ecstasy or rapture kind of prophecy. And Shmuel was leading them. Shmuel was standing over there leading them because Shmuel is teaching them. This is the most explicit description of the guild of the prophets that we know of from the times of Shmuel and Sefer Malachim, where Shmuel is coaching these prophets, leading them in a rapture prophecy, a meditation of sorts. Vatiya malachi Shaul ruach Elohim. And so Shaul's messengers were seized by the spirit also. They also were seized by it. So what happens? So they told Shaul was the Malachim went, and they weren't successful. They're still there, and they didn't hurt David. So he sent a second set and a third set, and all of them had the same thing. They all ended up joining the Nevi'im and certainly not hurting David. Now, whether David is also having prophecy or he's off to the side is unclear from the text. So now, we have a pattern that we are familiar with. We saw it several times in the past, but most notably at the beginning of chapter 3, of the 3+1, three repeated events without resolution, and the fourth is the resolution.
We have that here. Vayagidu Shaul. So they told Shaul what happened. Vayilach kamhu harmata. So Shaul himself went up to Ramah. Vayavod bor hagadol asher basechu. He came to a very big cistern that was near Ramah in Sechu. Vayashal vayomer efo Shmuel. So he asked, where's Shmuel? Which, of course, replicates Shaul's request a long, long time ago, at the beginning of his path, back in chapter 9, when he said, where is the Roah? And the girls tell them in the long story. Here he says, where is Shmuel v'David? Vayomer hinei b'nayot baramah. And they tell him. And he's told, it's up in Nayot. Vayelech sham el Nayot baramah, v'ti alav gamhu ruach Elohim. He went up there and he was also seized by the Spirit. Vayelech haloch v'it nabe ad ba'om b'nayot baramah. And he walked, and as he walked, he continued to have this spirit, and all the way until he got to Nayot of Ramah. So now Shaul is seized with the Nevi'im, and this is, of course, 3+1, three sets of agents, and then Shaul himself is seized by it. This, by the way, seems to be the textual parallel or foundation for the famous story in the Midrash about the three sets of messengers that Unklus's uncle Titus sent to seize him, that all of them were convinced by his argument and left him alone. And this also seems to be the basis for, not the basis, but sort of a parallel for a later story in Tanakh where Ahaziyahu sends three sets of messengers to kill Eliyahu, and they are all killed. In this case, that's Eliyahu style. In this case, this is Shmuel style. They're all seized by Nevuah. So what happened? He took off his clothes. Evidently, it means his royal garb. And he was there all day and all night, seized by this prophecy. In the meantime, we'll find David ran away. And that's why people say Agam Shaul Banavim. So we now have two different stories of Shaul being a Navi, being part of this rapture group that's prophesizing. We had one in chapter 10 as part of his signs that Shmuel gave him, and we have it now in chapter 19 in a very different context, where a terrible evil is averted by having him seized by this prophecy, allowing David to run away. And in either case, that's why people have that phrase, Agam Shaul Banavim. We have completed our study of chapter 19, and Amir Tzashem, in the next podcast, we will take up chapter 20, a very momentous chapter, where Shaul and David finally go their separate ways, and never to meet, at least under friendly circumstances, again. Everyone should have a wonderful day.